guess we try to give this a shot. I have no idea if it'll come out well or too much background noise or what, but or if it make us too distracted.
Hello. How are you?
I'm
great.
Fine, right?
Good. Thank you. And I'm Seneca. I'll be your server tonight. Welcome back. How are you recently?
Yeah, we're all.
We do have just a few specials today. We have a tomato jalapeno bisque as the soup of the day with charred scallion creme fraiche on top. We have some tacos of the day as an appetizer, grilled steak, pico de gallo, arbol chili hot sauce, and lime crema. They're two for order on the soft corn tortillas. And we have a flatbread pizza tonight. It's chicken enchilada pizza. So there is a spicy black bean puree as the base. I think maybe a little enchilada sauce kind of over that. Cheddar cheese, mozzarella, grilled chicken, scallions, and some sort of peppercorn drizzle.
The chef doesn't know it as well as you
do. Maybe not. I'll give you a minute to look everything over.
Thanks.
Hey.
Well, one of their specialties is fried dill pickles.
Oh yeah, that's pretty good. It's a little hot. When it comes out, you have to be careful. Because it's too hot to eat at first. But so what was it like being dead?
Well, I hardly noticed. Coming back was very slow.
Right.
It took a lot longer than I realized at the time.
Sense of time was
corrupted. So when it actually happened, I had no clue what was going on. And I was trying to think when I heard that I had died, and I can't remember that.
Oh, even the first time back.
Yeah.
So it was a cardiac event, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was it? And just kind of lights out?
Well, it was, it was just a complete shutdown of cardiac events. It was the last cardiac event. And I went to the hospital. Then I was in a rehab hospital for a couple of weeks. Back to the hospital for further whatever, and honestly, you know, pretty much in a daze, but 2 weeks of rehab and then back to Mass General for the finale.
So when they talk about death, is that mostly the brain death measurement, or how is it, how are they gauging it?
I think it was, you know, my heart wasn't beating.
All right. Just that.
Traditional
simple as that.
Test.
Yeah, yeah.
They didn't even let me breathe on a mirror.
So you had really good response with the EMS people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Literally two minutes. And I don't know what happened, whether they took me to Newton Wellesley and then straight on downtown Our order of grilled pickles there, diaphragm, the old pickles.
Perfect.
And I'll have the French dip for this.
French dip with fries or a salad?
Salad.
Salad? Great. Thank you.
Could I get a Spy Ponder Amber Ale, please?
Sure, yeah.
And could I get the, I tried the steak tacos.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that the main?
Sure. Dog main.
Okay.
Great.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Do you want anything to drink?
Oh, yes. What do you have on tap?
We have, actually, a lot right here. They're listed darkest to lightest as much as we could, you know,
Oh, I'll have Sam Adams Summer.
Summer? Great. Thank you. I can leave this here in case we switch it up. Thanks.
So you're saying that, yeah, good response to the EMS, 2 minutes.
Yeah.
So, like in general, would you say you're not much of a spiritual man or not a...
No, not.
Okay, so...
Oh, really.
So pretty much...
I don't pound on the table about being an atheist.
Right,
or
right.
Or that, but... There's enough going on in this world to keep me entertained. I don't need to worry about the next world.
Yeah, yep. I mean, personally, I've... you know, just with that... You know, I guess you get into ideas of, like, living on poetically. Mm-hmm. You know, I know it seems like a lot of people who are looking to sort of supernatural explanations, it seems, for at least a big chunk of them, part of the appeal is the whole, you know... life ever after thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, which I think you can do maybe at best poetically. So there was a great, you actually, on the text here you mentioned, you know, Who Wants to Live Forever, and, yeah. And there's a good book, I forget who by, but it's called The History of the World in 10.5 Chapters. And the final chapter is sort of, it's a fun take on like the, like one version of the Christian afterlife, mm-hmm. which is pretty much like here, but a little bit nicer, and you get more choice about exactly the details of it, and it's forever.
Uh-huh.
And its point is that, like, no matter how just, like, nicely pleasant it is, and how many, you know, conversations with, you know, Gandhi and MLK Jr., or whatever you've arranged, or whatever, or how much you perfect your golf game so, until the point where, like, every shot is a hole-in-one, just because you have millennia to perfect it, eventually you get bored. And that... I think that's the fundamental takeaway, is that, like, we're just finite creatures,
yeah.
not designed for that.
No, I mean, people say they want to live forever. They don't think I do.
I think, too, the whole world, you know, you always want to be a responsible citizen and, like, worry about the next generations and the future of the planet, and understand that, like repetition is the best way that nature knows infinity. You know, it's the way it makes more, and you want to respect that. But on the other hand, I think once you know and accept the limit, suddenly a lot of problems are less problematic in terms of what you have to worry about.
Yeah, well, I recently been aware of, well, I don't have to worry about that. All of these future events are
right.
off the table. And... really don't have any interest for me once I'm gone. I hope I'm remembered, but yeah.
Do you think you have you overcome? I think a lot of people naturally feel a bit scared. I mean, it's just naturally.
Sam, Spy Ponder Amber.
Great, thank you.
No.
Just.
Doesn't scare me at all. It wasn't scary the first time. I don't think it'd be scary the last time. The thing you're afraid of really is, you know, lingering locked-in syndrome or something like that. You know, painful, slow death. I have reason to believe I won't have a painful, slow death.
Yep.
So that I don't worry about that. Just dying at all.
Do you keep in your head any kind of bucket list, or have you pretty much thinking that
I'm alive. I've been alive a long time. I've done a lot of things. I'm still alive. I'll still do some more. But do I really need to go to Mallorca? Bucket list. I mean, universe in a grain of sand has always been my motto. And there's as much interesting going on between your toes, particularly if there's sand there, as anywhere else.
Yep.
And I've enjoyed the places I've gone, I have happy memories, all sorts of things, but no.
I really respect that outlook. I mean, and actually I find it very natural, though sometimes I'm worried it's just because...
Hi, Pickles.
Oh, great.
They are very, very hot. Yeah. Just use caution.
Thank you.
That's clear. Thank you.
Two people warning us.
Yeah.
I told myself. But, yeah, I know for me, I sometimes worry that... Do you mind if I have a
few? No.
I have that problem where sometimes I'll limit the goals I set for myself because I don't want to fail. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I've sort of cultivated that, like, find the low hanging fruit and if I spin it a little bit too much, I can make it like a Taoist kind of thing that's like, oh, I go up the uncarved block and find that natural course and that's how I find where I find strength. The negative for you of it is like, no, I just find it safer to not try and not fail than to try and fail, because the result's the same and I feel better about myself. So that said, I do keep...
Well, setting realistic goals helps you from failing. If you achieve everything you try, you're really not trying hard enough,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, continual incremental improvements on whatever it is that you're hacking out of life makes a lot more sense to me than saying I want to be a millionaire or whatever.
Yep.
Very strange. I mean, my house is worth $1 million more than it was when I bought it. No big plan or anything.
Yep.
I just moved into it and bought half of it.
Yep.
Bought the rest of it.
Yep.
And it was shooting up, so I bought it with a partner and then bought him out. But when we bought it, it was $318,000. Now it's $1.3 million. And it's all for Dave and Dan. That's not for me.
Wow, that's like, you said from 18,000 to a million plus? Or how? What did you say the current one? Or it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
But I'm just trying to get the scale of the order of magnitude we're talking here.
It was a reasonable price for a young guy to put into a house. And now it's a really expensive house.
So what are the... I don't know. Do you tend to have? Do you think you have a big? If you had like singular messages you'd want to share with the world or future generations, or things that you think it took you a while to get the hang of that you'd want to tell other people?
I have to think about that. A message to the future. A lot of things that everybody knows, but they just don't follow through on. I don't lie to people and, you know, things like that. It just seems obvious. The older I get, the more good advice sounds. But I think I always knew it was good advice, but the older I get, the more sense it makes to follow guidance.
And I know part of your being dead practice, experience, I always love, tell me again about the music that brought you back.
Well,
actually the victim. She's like, why is
I'm pretty sure. About this, but basically, my brothers brought in a cassette player or something and played Check That and Roll by Big Joe Turner. Far and away, my favorite song has been since it was a hit. And big thrill for them was that I was hitting the beat, even though I was unconscious. Hitting the beat, and so that was, you know, that meant to them I wasn't going to be a drooling idiot when I did come out of the coma, and I wasn't.
And before that, you're pretty unresponsive in general, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Reminds me of, there's a famous story with, I think, Mel Blanc. And I think the doctor thought to ask him, what's up, you know, or was it, it's not like, are you there, Bugs? And he's like, what's up, Doc? And got that response, and that was where they ran from there.
Yeah. I don't know about Dan. David's never watched my TED Talk. He says, well, someday I may watch it. He doesn't. He's old.
And so as, has music always been an important part of your life?
Oh, yeah.
So I know you as the drummer emeritus from JP Honk.
Yeah.
What other kind of things have you done, or just as the audience or performer?
Performer, mostly. Oh, audience too.
Yeah, yeah.
My mom and I grew up in South Georgia, and I've heard Drinking Wine, Spodeoda, Drinking Wine, Mop. Last night, and I remember that she and I used to listen to that together. She was.
What? I don't know this. What's the song?
Drinking that mess is my their delight. We can get. Drinking wine, Spodeoda, drinking wine, mop, mop. Wine, Spodeoda, drinking wine, mop, mop. Wine, Spodeoda, drinking wine, mop, mop. Pass that bottle to me. You got a nickel, I got a dime. Let's get together and buy sweet wine, drinking wine. That's it.
Cool.
It's a great song, and I really loved it, still do. So... this is in South Georgia, and we had a radio program called Jack the Bellboy. He was a white guy, but it was a rhythm and blues program. And, so I was always on the music. So I, from the time I was... well, that was a hit when I was six.
Yeah. And so, you said you're from Georgia boy, right? How did you get to the Northeast?
Just lucky, I guess. Well, my folks did not want me to go to school. They didn't think you should go to school in the same place where you grew up.
Some smarts there.
So I went to Purdue. I grew up in South Georgia and I went to Purdue. I went there because they had engineering and they had a good English department. And it turned out that the English department was important to me, more important than the engineering. Huh. It was funny, my dad said, well, you just made the reverse decision that I made. He loved to write and so forth, but he was an electrical engineer. As he used to say, an electrical engineer when you could get electrocuted doing it.
Yeah, nice, yeah. It's interesting that, I mean, I just had a slight parallel with me where I went to, in my case, Tufts. without much of a plan besides, well, maybe English, maybe an English teacher. They had a good education and a good English program there. And then to dodge a math class, to dodge calculus specifically, I started taking a computer science class in its stead. But it turned out that was what kind of clicked. And so I kept the double major. And so, yeah, I really do appreciate that, you know, understanding kind of both worlds. What kind of careers did you have?
I worked, I wrote for the school paper, and when I graduated, I went to Chicago, because that was the big city, that's where we were supposed to go. I worked for places, once famous place called the City News Bureau of Chicago.
Oh, wow.
And that was a cooperative sort of local AP, as it were. And we did all of the grunge work of suicides and murders and car crashes and all that sort of stuff. And then I ended up...
So what years were those around? Roughly
62, 63. Oh.
Distant times.
Yeah, very distant. And and it was basically minor league training for working for a paper. No, and I ended up at a paper called Chicago's American, which was a former Hearst paper owned by the Chicago Tribune. As we used to say, housed in the left wing of the Chicago Tribune building. But it was an afternoon paper. Afternoon papers were more sensational than morning papers. They don't have afternoon papers anymore. But that was the deal. You had to get street sales. So it was definitely a more sensational journalistic environment. And I worked there with, basically, a lot of these guys were legendary journalists. The guy, Harry Romanoff, was the city editor. He'd been Night City editor. He'd been Night City editor for, you know, just since the 20s or something, a long, long time. And, you know, he could talk tan off of paving beauty. I mean, he was just so... Well, you really had to sort of be corrupt to be a reporter. Poking into people's private business and so forth. I remember one night, I was talking to a woman whose husband had died, and said something about, "I'm sorry to disturb you at a time like this." And she said, "I wasn't sleeping anyway."
Yeah.
So I did that for several years, and I decided that if I was going to be a writer, I really ought to learn to type. Two-finger typist. I never developed a four-finger.
Oh, yeah.
Fancy way. And so I went to the YM.
Gentlemen, French dip?
French dip, right there.
Me.
There you go. And the taco.
Taco. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's see, where was I?
Learning to type.
Learning to type. I went to the YMCA College in Chicago to learn to type. And being back in the classroom just really flipped my switch. And I said, I want more education. I'm not done being educated.
we like any salt and pepper or anything else at the moment? All right, enjoy.
Thank you. Sorry, I lost the thread.
So you got back in education, excited by...
I went to Washington University to study social science, political science, actually. It was a one-year program, and part of it was working for this magazine called, Transaction, which was aiming to be the Scientific American of Social Science, the goal of the mag. So I worked on that for a while, several years. I worked there 1 year, it was a scholarship, and then they liked me and they gave me another year. I never completed a master's degree because I knew I wasn't going to get a PhD. But I didn't want to be a master's degree with little short sleeves at graduation.
Yep.
So I just did 2 years of graduate study. And then, where did I sit? Washington University. Done. I can't remember how I made this. Got from there to here.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
'70s, I was attempting to be a freelance writer, but my real problem was I always got really interested in what I was doing. I wrote too long, too much, did too much research, all of that. Excuse me.
I tell you, it's funny when you talk about that. Maybe I'll try to talk so I have time to enjoy your friendship. Like lately, I've just gotten into. I mean, I've been into digital photography for a while, like since the mid '90s, and I've just been going back just over the past couple weeks and deciding to pick out like 12 of the most interesting pictures from each year. And I'm finding it very empowering because it's very easy to lose your sense of place as years go by, as years become decades, and you're like, man, what was 2011 about?
Yeah.
You know, just like, here's an entire year of life, you know, we're 365 days. It's more than we think. Like, our monkey brains just get lost in the pattern and forget to realize that every day is, like you're saying, like a universe in a grain of sand kind of a thing. But once you have all those, those little grains of sand in a row, they all start to look alike if you don't pay attention. And so, but it's interesting hearing too, like we're going over, you're talking about sharing some of your history, and I'm like, and you're just like, oh yeah, so that's the 70s, and I'm like, oh, I feel kind of old, I'm like, oh, that's when I was being born, you know, like, so.
Well, the, just had a way of taking off on this, just slipped the gears again, it was a long time ago. After I graduated, or not graduated, after I'd been there for a couple of years, I got a job offer at a program on science and technology at Harvard. Research associate or something like that. And they were doing exactly that, the impact of technology on on Cesare.
And what year is this around, roughly?
This would be... mid... still in the 70s.
Wow.
And that was very challenging. Met a lot of smart people. And again, still aware that I was not an academic at heart anyway.
And so funny, sometimes I feel like children of the 70s and 80s, we've got to feel like we invented technology somehow, or like, or first become aware of its ability to kind of changes culturally. But, you know, so much happened, from airplanes to the telephone system to radio to just all these things. And it's funny, I mean, today I was looking at just a video about like how it's made of like tennis balls.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fortuitously timed because I just happened to have noticed a sort of dog eating or something tennis ball on the side of the road. You know, and you could just see its guts a little bit. And I was like, wow. You know, if for some reason there's some like major sad societal disruption and you couldn't get fresh tennis balls, like it'd be like people who like tennis would miss them.
Yeah.
And it's true, when I saw this video then, it's just like this amazing process of just like, it's still very manual, like they don't have robots over everything. It's still some guy whose job is like to take all the balls out of the mold and turn them the right way and all this stuff. And I'm surprised that it wasn't even more automated, but there's some quote that says like, you know, like without technology, even like a pencil is a miracle.
Yeah.
And I think it's really easy to take that for granted about how much mechanical engineering has gone on in the world to make it as manufactured as it can, as it is.
That was Perot's family business. Pencil manufacturing.
Perot? Oh, the politician.
Henry David.
Oh, Henry David Thoreau. Sorry, I said Perot. No. The the guy with the ears in the Texas. Yeah, it was sort of like the... Well, I don't know, let's say almost akin to the printing press, but obviously different, but still very enabling technology and just let people... I mean, so many of these things are just part of our lives and we don't even think of them as interesting, but...
Yeah. Well, certainly the program was sponsored by IBM, and I challenged the boss. So that's basically blood money, right? And so, yep. They're paying for what they did.
I see. The agenda. I'm trying to remember if that was during the IBM Think days. They had those little plaques that just, you know, reminded them to think.
Yeah. I did that for a while.
Everything.
Wonderful. Thank you. The next great experiment was being a freelance writer. I think, as I said, my problem with that was I just get too damn interested in this stuff. Do it. So that's how my wife got into working, was that I wasn't making much money and she needed to do it too, so that was a good stimulus for her.
How did you meet your wife?
At Purdue.
Oh, wow.
College sweethearts.
So she's with you through all this?
No, everything.
Wow.
We were married 50 years and 8 days.
Oh.
So one. A lot of things that would have, might have happened didn't happen because I was taking care of her. Because she had a stroke. And I had to take care of her.
She's incapacitated?
Yeah, pretty much. Eventually, definitely. She never got any better.
Right.
Eventually it got worse, but we love to laugh, so we just lots of things that were funny about having an incapacitated stroke. If you haven't had one or dealt with it, you don't know what it is, but
right.
We had a good time. I can't believe.
I tell you, so my dad had a kind of incapacitating seizure when I was 14 or so, and I think I understand the power of just the sort of enabling and healing pleasure of black humor to the situations, and the one I remember from him was he had been an RN. He hadn't practiced as an RN, but he's actually thinking about a career switch, and he got his RN degree fairly shortly before he finally had a stroke. And so his first official diagnosis was, you have spinal meningitis. I guess your farts don't smell. Not realizing that, no, he'd actually lost his sense of smell entirely. And we are all able to disabuse him of the notion that the symptom of spinal meningitis is farts not smelling. But, you know, and it is that kind of, you know, very dark humor and just kind of having to roll with it.
Yeah.
How old were you when you, so you have, how many kids?
Two children. Two kids. Three grandchildren. David's children.
Yep.
So I think of the next little Zach. I remember once Anne was basically lying there staring at the ceiling in the hospital. The nurse came in and said, how are you today? Fine.
Can I get a small Guinness?
That was her attitude toward life.
Please. Did somebody want that last pickle? You want me to take it?
Twist my arm.
So it was just sort of having that was a definite interruption.
How long was it between the stroke and her final passing?
Death.
I know, right? I'm using the euphemisms already. It's hard. How long between the stroke and death?
5 years.
5 years. Wow. That is a
well,
long time.
It was like, you know, 2 years of is she going to get better?
Yeah, yeah.
3 years of she's not going to get better. But we kept our thing going, you know.
Yep.
Sentimental thing to think about.
Yeah. I saw that one picture of her. I mean, just the kind of glowing one. I mean, it's seemed like a really special person.
Oh, she was. Sister-in-law said she always thinks of Anne sitting there smiling. happy person.
So, not that this is his story, but your brother also made it somehow, apparently from Georgia to the Northeast, too.
Well, my brother Jim, little brother, ended up here. Other brother, the one I live with now, was all over. He lived in Houston, he lived in San Francisco, had a rich life experience, all in all. Ended up here, but it must have had something to do with me.
You were first?
Yeah.
Great. Do you tend to get like sentimental about the idea of having kids? Like, is something you say what you do, or is just a decision they need to make for themselves, or...
Well, Jim didn't have any kids. My brother Dave has two kids. He's on good terms with one of them. He's not on good terms with the other. He's sort of an asshole about some things. Paying the price for that. But I'm close to his kids.
Yeah.
David started having kids. First few years, I mean, you know, one of them's out in California now, and one of them's teaching up in Minnesota, et cetera. So I'm not as close touch as I was when they were little. But it was. Yeah, having kids was a very natural thing for me. Lots of expectations. So for a long time I worked at Harvard.
Right on her thighs, yeah. She leaned over to pick something up, and I was distracted for a moment. Let's just put it there. Easily distracted. But let's get back to so tell me again, what has music been? What have you done with music in terms of your life?
Well, I listened to and loved music all my life. I played in a little band in my dormitory at college.
Drums or something else?
Drums. Nothing much came of that. Then I got away from it for a while, and then all of a sudden in the 60s came along, and everybody was having a band, and I just ended up in a band.
So playing the full set? Drum set?
Drum set, yeah.
Nice.
Very, I can keep a good beat, never practiced as much as I should have. And playing rock and roll, you know, keeping a good beat is pretty much all you need to be able to do.
Yep.
It's called Velocette after the motorcycle, because it was a single-cylinder motorcycle. The business card's single-cylinder rock and roll.
Yeah. I like that. It's like sort of kind of nicely humble, you know, like not like trying to, it's better to, what do they say? It's better to under-promise and over-deliver than the reverse.
Well, I would say kind of the opposite of yes. We were a real little rock and roll.
It's cool. And I grew up, I know that feeling about never practicing enough. My excuse was I was always in, you know, I was playing tuba in like, you know, six bands at once, like two or three at school and two at church. But, and also, you know, I think sometimes the rhythm section, if you're not going to make a full-time living of it, you can kind of coast a little bit in terms of, you know, you need to have certain strengths and ability to pull a group together and be that kind of heartbeat. But sometimes technically you have fewer, you know, musically technical challenges, and it sometimes the struggle is as much physical as, and which is why, you know, I know that's one of the reasons why, you know, it's definitely a bummer that we don't, that you know, you probably don't have the same gusto to make the JP Honk gig.
Well, I just can't march anymore. I can't walk that far.
Yeah.
And I tried to get to a couple of practices, and I'd love to do that more.
Yeah, we
I always put a lot of stock in stamina, and then when I ran out of it, I learned why I put a lot of stock in it.
I hear you. I mean, right now, I mean, I'm again, relatively, compared to you, still a relatively young, spry guy. And I do all my tuba dancing, right?
Yeah.
And of course, I'm just like, there's definitely this old kind of Ohio son of farm boy kind of thing where, like, and also that kind of marching band toughness, you know, like, oh, any weather, we're established army Christmas kettles, hours at a time, and now it takes its form of, gotta be out there dancing, I don't care that I'm wearing a 25-pound piece of metal, I'm gonna be swinging it and move everything around. Thanks.
You ever play a real bass?
Oh, like a string bass? No, I don't, I never picked, I took some lessons on a bass guitar, and I understand the theory of it a little bit, but never did for real.
So, you know, they say doubles in brass, but you didn't double in strings.
Yeah. Maybe I should actually. I know a guy who has this. If I have a couple extra $100 or maybe $700 to spend, maybe get a bass ukulele. Have you seen these things?
Yeah.
They're tiny, but the strings are this beautiful, rubbery. It's so gentle compared to like a harsh like metal bass, you know, bass guitar string. It's like gong gong, and it sounds exactly like a full upright bass.
Wow.
It's a beautiful kind of thing. And I'm thinking maybe I should.
Get into a ukulele band.
Yeah, and I know enough people who have like gone the other way that I should like maybe step up and expand my horizons a little bit. Just not being just the tuba guy.
Well, my son Dan plays tuba, bass. And somebody asked him, why do you want to do that? And he said, well, you're in charge of the rhythm, you're in charge of the harmony.
Yeah?
Why wouldn't you want
it? It's nice. It's definitely the core of things. So just to swing to, I don't know, politics for a bit. Is it fair to say you're kind of on the liberal side of things, lefty? Yeah. Has that always been the case? Was that the case growing up? How was it in the turn of that environment?
Well, my mom ran for school board. early 50s, and this is again in South Georgia. And when Brown versus Board of Education came down, they just very calmly said, well, we better appoint a subcommittee to see what impact this is going to have on without us the Georgia school system. And that was enough. The state attorney general was threatening them with prosecution because it was against the law in the state of Georgia to think about integrating the schools.
Yeah.
And we were a lot of hang up phone calls, people calling us at all hours. And, they never let me know how much was going on, but I knew a lot of what was going on. So, anyway, short story that my dad was a born and grew up in North Florida, but from a Boston family, and they always thought of themselves as a Boston family, even though they were in Florida. And so it's just by reason of, you know, being halfway attentive, he was a liberal, just because it wasn't instinctive reaction to anything. And so when the Klan was harassing my mom, even though they didn't let me know what was going on, I knew something was going on. And so I think I just came to think that way. And it's been really surprising sometimes that some subject comes up and I just come out with a liberal view on it. I've never thought about it or anything else, but I think of it as, you know, the people who think about politics and the people who don't think about politics. The ones who do are all liberals, in a way. Kind of self-serving, but...
Yeah, I mean...
Personally, my experience over the past 5 or 10 years, and I'm definitely leaning left, but... I mean, sometimes I joke, I try to be an extremist moderate, but that's not the case. I definitely lean left. But I do try to do... I mean, over the past couple of years especially, I've become more aware of almost the tribalism of some of the beliefs on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And that... And recognize even there's some of the views I hold that aren't... As much as I like to think they are, just kind of pure rationality and empathy and all the things that I do associate with the best types of liberalism, but also just because it's kind of what's expected to be among, kind of with my peer group. And I think there's a lot of that on both sides. And the other thing, in terms of talking with some of my more either libertarian or just sometimes just plain right-wing friends, a lot, sometimes it does come down to different starting assumptions. Like, sometimes there is a lot of logic in what they say if you started from the same place they did. Like, I guess the idea is, like, to wear the moccasins, to quote the old bad proverb. You also have to start where they're starting walking.
No.
Because that does make a lot of things. I mean, and for me right now, my current favorite thing to point my finger at is this type of fundamentalism, which, especially in this country, is often religious, but also can be doctrinaire. I mean, I would say, you know, communists in Russia were just as fundamentalist about what it must be. And the idea of putting doctrine in front of people and thinking that you have the answers, even when the questions have not been fully formed.
Well, I was, you know, coming into awareness when McCarthy was kicking up a storm. And I said, I'm not going to have an ideology. It's not good for you. It's a complicated way of being stupid. And so I never ended up sort of vaccinated by seeing that going. So I never went off on any radical toots at all, even in the 60s, I was marching and all of that, of course. And from my point of view, is really, you know, why are we in Vietnam? What advantage to the country is this? If we weren't in there, how much difference would that make to the United States? Not much.
So you've been, you mentioned McCarthy, and obviously you were around and with Nixon and all this stuff. Is the stuff today, is it particularly worse, or is it just the thing of the moment?
Oh, I think that, I think it's much milder now. I think that everybody, I mean, you've got a lot of rabid right-wingers and so forth, but I think the political scene is much more moderate and reasonable than it was back then.
More reasonable?
Yeah.
Wow. I have so many... It's interesting what kind of effect, especially social media, tends to have. And also, in my view, you know, just some of the specialized media, right? Like now there's not just three networks that kind of give you a sort of roughly balanced view, but you have, like, ones that cater to a specific viewpoint, so you never have to hear the alternate viewpoint or that moderate view. And I hear so many friends that are like, oh my God, end of the world, you know, like, at every turn. And it's you know, it's reassuring to hear that, like, from your point of view, like, no, things are, you know, things are what they are. And
yeah. I wouldn't say I've seen it all, but I've seen a lot, you know, and it's kind of hard to get excited about things. Certainly, I think Obama is the best president we've had in a long, long time. And he's certainly my favorite politician of all time. So there's an example of, you know, takes me out. You know, I really count on this guy. He's not going to do anything stupid much. I mean, he's in politics, and there's things that have to happen. But it's not a matter of keep losing the thread of what we're talking about. But
say how much you liked Obama, and then you thought it was a pretty good.
Except for the international trade thing, that's the only thing where I'm not comfortable with. But I do think that basically politics is the field of dispute over the distribution of relatively rare resources. And so it's just, you know, liberal, conservative, whatever. And it's all the same stuff that they're trying to control. And I just feel much more in line with the people who are trying to control things because they understand them, rather than the people who want to make things be the way they already understand. Because I don't think there's any point of being reactionary, you know, make America great again. Which part of it did you like best?
Right.
One of the things I really like about Facebook is suddenly being in touch with people who you went to high school with, since everybody I went to high school is now reactionary, or most of them are.
Yeah.
And in any way, anybody who lives down there is just cut off from the universal discourse of the rest of the country. But it's fun to sort of joust with them because they never have an answer to it.
Right.
They never change, but they stick these little memes and things out there, and I just shoot 2,000 holes in it, and that's the last we hear of that. And then try another one.
Yep.
I think they sometimes feel like they have a tiger by the tail, but they should feel that way. And I have the advantage of, you know, being a Georgia boy, and I understand the way they think. And, so that's fun. Become aware of living with my brother. I was a not a literal country boy. I lived in a small town. He lived there for a while, but basically he's in a suburban Atlanta childhood, not a
small
spurs and dirt roads childhood like I had. So he doesn't have he's just not a country boy compared to most people I am.
How sorry, it's a total tangent. How long have you had been with the beard?
Well, I was looking at a picture the other day. I think I must have had it since I cut my hair short. I never felt like having a beard if my hair was too long. But when I cut my hair short, I grew it. So that would have been in 75 or something like that. There's a picture of looking at this the other day with me with this great bushy black beard.
I'm noticing, the reason was I was going with my pictures, I just noticed like, oh, when I first started this, which is only like around 6 years ago, it's like, oh, it really wasn't as dominant gray as it now is. Like, and now I still have these weird stripes where it doesn't want to be quite completely gray. But sometimes, actually, I think it's a little looking like, oh, maybe in a couple decades, I'm sort of like looking at, you know, give or take a pair of glasses or something, what I might be aiming for.
Well, I read an article about Wolf Blitzer's beard. And, of course, he wasn't done in the makeup department. But his is trimmed, just gotten down to the same length all over.
Yeah, yeah.
And I have one of those offset shaver deals.
Yeah.
And I have it at the closest cut. But I often thought, particularly recently, go to the barber just to get a beard trim, because the hair doesn't grow as fast as it used to.
Yeah.
And with the trimmer, I can't get it as even as it seems to promise it would do. But I think I would like to have it, you know, be much shorter on the lower. I've always thought of it as a kind of a layout type problem. You want to have some weight, because I have a round face.
Yeah, yeah.
You want to have some weight on the bottom.
Wait, yeah. My concept, maybe again coming with a round face, was like, it's nice to have actually some lines on it. You know, like just like, and a face is all curves.
Yeah.
You know, having a little bit of contrast with some kind of lines. I'm not, unless I'm, you know, sometimes you need to like, try to emphasize the chin. I'm not even there. I'm just trying to get it, not make it look, the neck look too scruffy and trim a little here, but then just kind of, yeah, some kind of presence.
There was a guy I was talking to about his beard, and he had a little sideburns came down to a point, and he had this little narrow, quarter of an inch wide beard.
Yeah, yeah.
I just don't have the patience.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of sculpting. I think too. Once it's good if your hair is a strong, like right now my beard is kind of gray. Your beard is gray.
No.
It'd be a little harder to see. Like I think you need that kind of like darkness to. You're gonna really pull it off.
Every once in a while, I think, what if I shaved it all off?
Huh? Yeah.
But
as a tuba player, I think of that more often sometimes. Like sometimes after if I've gone like a week or two without like trimming. And so I have this extra thing, and then I'm like, I have a really hard session, a couple hours of like playing away. I'm like, ow, that kind of hurts. It's what I regret. But, you know, vanity.
Yeah. So when you were in the Salvation Army, were you under a lot of pressure to be a Salvationist?
I didn't read as much as pressure, just because, especially my parents were ministers.
Yeah.
And in a way, it just, so I think I really wanted to be a good, you know, a good Christian Salvationist kid. And so, and I realized, I mean, my parents were pretty liberal as far as they could be in terms of that tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I might have instilled a sense of, frankly, you know, the threat of hellfire and damnation.
Yeah.
That like if you don't fly right, you're vulnerable for like eternal punishment.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the reasons why I'm sort of as in my head and rationalist a guy I am, because I'm like, well, I think subconsciously I'm like, I'm gonna be held to account for what I do, my actions.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can always justify it with like what it seemed to me at the time, that was like kind of a defensive mechanism. So I tend to be very sometimes lost and like out of touch with my gut and in touch with my head with this stuff because of that. So for what it's worth, my religious journey was then when I was a teenager realizing, well, here I am trying to be a really good Christian kid, but if I had been the son of, instead of being the sweet-talking son of the preacher man, I was a sweet-talking son of the imam, would I be trying just as hard to be a good Muslim? And it was that kind of cultural, it turned out that the main thing was important to me subconsciously. Like now as a postmodern influenced existential guy.
You're slowing down?
Yeah, I'm okay.
Still working or?
We're talking a lot.
Okay.
As sort of a postmodern existential guy, I realize how hopeless this is, but it's this need to be sort of like objectively correct,
mm-hmm.
or as close to objectively correct as I can be, because that seems like cosmically important to me. So the realization that my religious upbringing and what I held to be true wasn't super fundamentalist, and I tried to kind of reconcile. Yeah, if you look at Genesis not as a science textbook, but as a way of sort of, you know, poetic way of describing planetary development, that kind of stuff. It was fairly easier, but even my efforts to do that were influenced by my need. I realized they were kind of culturally constructed,
mm-hmm.
and so that meant that it wasn't like true in the way that I needed to be true necessarily. And the same way with, I love it, like I was trying to be a good Sunday school kid, and I mean when I was. Not to be too crude, but to get to second base of the gal, it's kind of, I do it, but I feel guilty about it, you know? And I had other friends who seemed to be, have less of a spiritual questioning, but doing more of that party stuff.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was jealousy or what, but it's like, well, that can't be right. And then it was also, every year, like clockwork, I'd go to this Salvation Army music camp,
mm-hmm.
The kind of territorial one, and it was really odd to me. The first Sunday, they'd have a, you know, church meeting, and a gang church meeting. And the second Sunday, they'd have another church meeting, often with a slightly more, the bigger guns preacher or whatever, like kind of an import guest. But every year, like clockwork, there's a big kind of pseudo-revival. In the Salvation Army, there's a tradition of the altar call. And the idea is, at the end of the meeting, you're often presented, you know, if you feel the need to get right with God, come to the front. And almost like small group ministering, you know, like one person alone or a small group would get the attendance of a, you know, of a person in the church, and they'd talk it over, and you know, very cathartic. I mean, now sophisticated, I can see the value. As a sophisticated sort of guy, I can kind of see the value of that from a psychology point of view.
Yeah.
But back then, it was like, I think God should move in more mysterious ways than this. like in terms of the clockwork aspect of every year, not the first Sunday, the second Sunday is the big.
Yeah.
And those three things meant to me that my religion that I grew up with wasn't the sort of objectively, universally, provably true as my sort of half science, half, not fundamentalist, but half science, half hardcore Christian, half needed. It needed it to be like true, and it wasn't. You know, since then I've come to sometimes second guess that, because I've realized I was kind of rebelling against maybe a straw man or a very brittle faith, and I do understand the value of certain traditions for people, and I don't want it. And I was hardly ever like hardcore, I don't think I was hardcore atheist, like no way, but I do realize, you know, at least for a while I was hanging a little bit more at the UU church, and I could understand the value of like the process and the questioning. So,
well, my dad was a Unitarian, and no Unitarian churches south of Atlanta.
And you're saying Boston Unitarian too,
yeah,
right?
Boston Unitarian.
Which is, because I think my understanding is, I'm not even sure if that was before the merge of it, before U became UU.
Yeah.
But I've also been led to understand other parts of the country, it's closer to like the Anglicans, whereas in this part of the country, it's more like, no, we accept very many traditions and look for that value.
Well, yeah, that that's true, but on the other hand, it's just like Unitarians up here, it's just like Methodists and Presbyterians, and it's just another church. Unitarians elsewhere,
yep,
you know, is a collection of rebels, comparatively speaking.
I hear what you mean, yeah. Here it's accepted, though, if you go inside the church, in my opinion, more so, you get some liberal, especially around, you know, Arlington, Cambridge, you get some liberal congregationalists or whatever, where in practice is probably as opening to different people from sexualities, to different everything, to different viewpoints, and a little bit more openness. But sometimes the UU, in my experience, in a way that I have not seen in other, you know, Christian-derived churches, you get this idea of like, maybe the Buddhists have something to say, yeah, to us, maybe the Hindus, maybe the Muslims, you know, like it's even more multi-path many ways kind of thing.
Well, it just dawned on me at about age 14. Mm-hmm. This is all bullshit.
It's a good age, yeah.
This is all bullshit. That's what I really came into. It wasn't any big spiritual crisis or anything like that. Used to believe it. Then some youth pastor or somebody was laying some kind of religious thing on me, and I was not that bad. And
I admit, in my heart of hearts, I respect people more when around the same age I did, you know, self-servingly, they had the same kind of spiritual about-face. Whether they became almost more religious or less religious, I respect it more when it's not just this exact, happens to be the exact same thing they grew up with, you know, as a preteen. I just think that's an important time where you need to, like, look around and think about, like, well, what is going on and what is really true?
Well, I was amazed when we moved to Atlanta and Dad started going to church. What's this? That girl, she can be in my army. It's already got the stripes. And I was really surprised. And then, so I used to go to church with him sometimes. And Martin Luther King spoke at his church.
Wow.
And this was in Atlanta. And I heard him speak there. This was before it was famous. But, you know, he was a, certainly a known personality at the time. And I was very impressed with him. That stuff, that I still got that. I don't have much religion anymore, but I certainly believe in the power of a preacher.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
Because it used to be, South Georgia Methodist, you had some real thunderings, you know.
You
really lay it down. I remember one thing, which I now understand has been nothing but a technique, but he was talking about a puppy or something like that. Everybody was quiet, sad because of the bad things happening to the puppy. Well, you're sad about the puppy, but what about your own immortal soul? Are you sad about that, etc.? Does this make any sense?
Yeah, yeah. A little bit too much for the gut, not for the head.
We used to have a Salvation Army college in my neighborhood in Boston, or in Chicago.
Do you think it's what they called a training school?
I guess for
their ministers?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
Isn't everybody a minister in Salvation Army?
So no, it's not quite like that. That's right. As far as I know, that's the shtick of the Mormons,
yeah.
Where everyone's ordained.
Yeah.
Salvation Army calls its ministers officers.
Yeah.
Versus the regular people who would just attend, but who have been sort of like roughly like the Catholic confirmed, they become soldiers. So they are considered soldiers and they're officers, and the whole thing is like. Sometimes I like to call it the goofy paramilitary wing of the Methodists, and they just took a metaphor and the idea of a war against sin, and kind of took it to a logical extreme. So if you're thinking of a college, I'm guessing it would be a school for officers training. See, as for the Salvation Army, divides the country into four territories, and Chicago I think would be a different territory. So I know the Eastern Territory, which is actually the Northeast. So I don't know as much so I can't confirm that, but it sounds about right.
Yeah. Spiffy uniforms.
Yep.
Very spiffy uniforms. Badges.
And it's funny how that became like when it started, in a way, that was sort of like a way of making this very egalitarian thing. Everyone wears the same thing. There, you don't have to wear your Sunday best. And then I think as the Salvation Army sort of lost some of its kind of blatant gung-ho-ism. Like, it used to be, you know, like thinking like guys and dolls, but it used to be very more consuming, sort of like what I think of as the Jehovah's Witnesses or like Mormons going on missionary duty.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, as far as I can tell, it's sort of mellowed and it isn't quite as street preachy as it used to be. But back when it was, you know, forms were like egalitarian, and now they're more the people who are just hardcore about the church versus the other people who just show up and, you know, their usual just relatively nice clothes. So, it's funny because parts of it are definitely, the theology is a little bit right wing. Not theology, but like, and my mom is one of the few liberal Democrats. You know, and there's some issues where, you know, she and I might be a lot more liberal than her on, but like, they're kind of mostly on board with assuming everyone in that place is Republican. Like, she's worked at the headquarters and the places, and there's definitely that affiliation. Which she's sad about because she. I mean, that's one thing I'm really getting the hang of lately. Christian, sort of folk Protestantism, American folk Protestantism, or folk Christianity, less so the Catholics, in my biased view. And my untrustworthy view.
It's a different deal.
Yeah. But, so sometimes I say Christianity, but I mostly think they're Protestants. And as a guy who grew up, again, kid of a preacher, and learned, you know, a fair chunk of Bible stuff, the amount of biblical stuff that just... The people I argue with sometimes who think they're... Who would claim they're coming from, like, the true Bible standpoint, like... It so much is just this reactionary, status quo preserving, this is what we think, but we're also using this kind of holy book that we're going to say is inerrant and protected by God and tells you pretty much everything you need to know, and that we're also faithful to its lessons, and just ignoring like 2/3 of it, you know, and never recognize, and not, again, I respect people more who are at least potentially, even if they don't live in their heads, able to justify things kind of, you know, intellectually and on paper and stuff. And these people never even get to that point. They never question, they never ask, they just kind of believe.
Well, I completely got out of it, you know, but I've always been glad that I was into it because it's very educational to know what's in the Bible and what people believe and all of that. I've always been glad that I knew a lot about religion, even though I wasn't in it before at all. But just to know the way religious people believe and, you know, just all the cultural references that are pretty much gone out of normal American life now. Daniel Lyons again, and that sort of thing. That was, you know, just a common currency when I was growing up. Nobody talks about Daniel Lyons again. I was very normal. I was a fundamentalist Protestant school. John the Baptist, my favorites. Just because he got out there before Jesus even came along. Jesus before Jesus.
Yeah, yeah. Let me get back to some of the theoretical justification for this really lovely dinner. Thank you very much for it that I've had. Do you think the experience with Anne, did that change how you viewed your own potential end, or how you feel about it, or is it? It's okay if no.
No.
I'm shooting out there.
It's a penetrating question.
Okay.
Friends of mine were in a band, and they had a song called "Immortality." Immortality. When you feel in your heart that you're not one of them. I never thought of that. Well, it took so long, so it wasn't a shock when she died. It took her a long time. And as I say, we had a lot of fun all along.
And roughly how old was she when she got the stroke and then 5 years more?
She was...
I mean, ballpark.
Yeah. She was 71 when she had the stroke. She died a few years later.
Okay. I just forgot the timing in terms of... Yeah. At least it wasn't a... cut down to the prime of youth.
No,
right.
Not at all. Rich, full life. Kids, grandkids. She had all of those experiences and traveling. So I certainly miss her because she was funny as hell.
That's absolutely one of the strongest points of my current suit. I say current. So like, of course, every love is going to be forever, right? That's the reason you're in love. But my sweetie, Melissa, is really funny. Yeah. It's really great quality.
Now, we were going through a bad patch one time. She was seeing a counselor or therapist or something. And the therapist at one point said, well, you know, you're having all these problems. Why don't you stick with it? He makes me laugh.
That is literally my dad's epitaph. He made us laugh. Is the thing.
Do you want another drink?
Oh, not me, thanks.
You know, can I get a just for dessert? Can I get the flip, the Cooper's flip?
Cooper's flip, yeah. Yeah.
Doesn't go with beer.
Yeah, it basically my excuse to like double up on booze and dessert. You know, but because it's you seem to have a talent for nursing there.
Yeah,
going slow. That's good. Take. More the merrier. More time the merrier.
It's little. You can use any of this you want in any way you want.
Okay,
excellent. I'd just like to see it, but...
Yeah. You'll have, and you'd have final, whatever the word is when you can say no. And it's interesting to think about what I might do with it in terms of... Actually, I don't even know what it... I've never tried to transcribe something as long as this lovely conversation. and then, of course, I know sometimes when I've done it in the past, I'm too slow to, like... Actually, we can cut out the ums and the uhs. The important thing is to get the message and take a slight liberties with that without taking too much liberty.
Well, I had a few long interviews with people when I was a reporter. At least in one case, I hired a transcriptionist to write it all down for me. And that helped a lot. Because she got rid of the ums and things like
that. Right.
Automatically. What was left was pretty much the substance of the conversation. So you want to make something out of it.
Yeah.
Think of that. I was going to show you, but then I forgot to bring it with me. I got this little Kindle reader, you know, and your book was on it, and I booted it up.
Oh, the comic book?
Yeah.
Is it black and white or is it color?
Black and white.
How did it come out? I was actually, one of the reasons why I'm less, I don't know, when I poured it over, I realized they compressed the images a bit, and I'm sort of afraid it doesn't do, my artist might think it wasn't doing justice to his work. Because like when you look at the print version or like this kind of vanilla version, he cares so much for the coloring and they compress it a little bit. But still, I like the message of that, you know, the book. And even though I've been too afraid, even when I remade it into a comic, I was too afraid to like edit it and kind of, I think I ended up making it too much of a sacred document. Like, oh, I didn't want to take the, at one point, a 10th or 11th grade English teacher, I wrote an essay and she loved it, and then I edited it and she's like, oh, now it's terrible. And so I'm always too slow to edit myself. But wow, I'm glad. So did most of what I said, and again, I wrote a lot of that when I was in my mid to young 20s. Do you think most of it holds up? Does most of it make some sense in terms of where I come from?
Yeah, I thought it was sound and interesting and entertaining. Or do you want?
I tell you, I'm thinking about making another comic book. This one is based on it's going to be like a sequel to my one comic, Young Astronauts in Love, which is sort of, as kind of recapitulating, you know, a bit of my own romantic college and high school experience, and also just because I had that one panel where like you just have the two astronauts going. Like embracing, and all you see is as their faces move closer, is the clunk, and that's Young Astronauts in Love, and just the mechanical difficulties, I guess, is the joke there. But I've been thinking about, there are a few ideas, philosophies that I'd really like to. Again, for a while, I think that I thought, and to say it's still true, my message that I'd like to spread to the world is for that subset of the world who are as uptight about death as I was. And sleepless nights, and paranoid, and like, ah. So, this sort of very odd, kind of surreal feeling of, how can I possibly end? How can this perspective end and life still go on? And there are times, I think a lot of people have, or a certain subset of people, me at least, have had this time in their life when like that just seems really bizarrely just scary and strange and hard to deal with. But I think getting those ideas down on paper really helps soothe me through there. But so anyways, that's the message I'd like to get to the world. The other message that's more lately is, it starts with a line from Nietzsche. Like, heaven forbid, right? I try not to be one of those, like, those fans of Nietzsche. But he talks about the Latin term amor fati. And the...
No worries.
And the concept of love of one's fate. Or sometimes I think about it as, like, kind of love of the circumstance. Mm-hmm. And the way I'm thinking about it, and I'm trying to think if I can get it into a comic book without getting it too preachy, but and still put it in a story, is this idea of, like, our monkey brains are so good at, like, coming up with alternate universes in our heads that are just like this one, so enough that we recognize all every bit of it, but it's a little bit nicer. It's like a universe, the parallel universe that's exactly like this one, but I'm not stuck in frickin' traffic! Or that this line for the grocery is not taking frickin' forever, or whatever small thing inconvenience that we have, and tend to blow out of control, but we're so good at thinking of those alternate worlds that it makes us miserable. And for me, the call of amor fati is to embrace this current circumstance, because it is the circumstance. It is what exists. And, you know, it's related, but not quite the same as sometimes, like, looking to the Pollyanna kind of silver lining to everything that can be a part of it, but doesn't have to be in my hopes for it. Or, oh, great. Thank you. Nor does it have to be like, let's see, sorry, I've sort of lost the train of thought. It's kind of hard to, but it's kind of a subtle thought in terms of, what amor fati, it can also mean, like, yeah, it just behooves one to just, like, love it because, oh, it is like life.
Yeah.
One part that's always there, which is kind of overlapping with silver lining, Kurt Vonnegut, in his book Cat's Cradle,
yeah,
he outlines a sort of last rites that people in his kind of made-up religion would say to each other. And part of it is sort of basically like, you know, there was God, and God got lonely, and God made mud, and he said to some of the mud, sit up, look around, look at all the things I've done. And then, like, now as mud prepares to go back to sleep, I look around and I think, wow, good job, God. I certainly couldn't have done that. It's really, really amazing. And so the upshot is just the idea of being sitting up mud. Or specifically, the relatively tiny, 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 tiny percentage of physical matter in this universe that got to be aware of what it was. That is sort of sometimes can tie into that a part of amor fati, that you are, regardless of the pain and inconvenience of life in the moment, combined with awareness of, like, the pleasant life I've lived, with a lot, you know, and I recognize as an uptight, you know, liberal male, my straight white male privilege that I've enjoyed and all this stuff, when that you know, it's almost a story for another time.
Not that straight.
Yeah. But all those are part of it, but also just because it is that we can love it, and it's a better life when we do love it. Like, and again, I try to avoid shoulds. Like, oh, you should love it. You know, shoulds are usually gets in a bad place, but you can, so you might as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that sometimes really, if I get a second tattoo besides my little alien running eyeball character,
mm-hmm,
if I get a second one, again, probably equally as wussy and, like, not, like, out in people's face, but it might be some way of trying to get, capture either more fatigue or the circumstance. And because I think having that as a physical reminder to myself that, like, sometimes it's as simple as, like, traffic, And, or as Homer Simpson put it, lousy minor setback, this world sucks. That is such a perfect reminder for myself to, like, don't be like Homer in that case. But it's so easy to, like, think this world sucks because of this momentary whatever. And anything that helps you get beyond that and to really love the circumstance, I think, is a good thing.
Well, just to be able to laugh things off is a great privilege and pleasure for me. Can't laugh everything off. My mom lost a child and really fucked her up.
Oh, how old was the child?
3 days.
Okay.
Not gonna live under the West.
Right, right.
Anyway, but.
Where was it in terms of, had she had children at that point, or that the first?
No.
Okay.
That would be her last child.
Oh, I see.
She had 3 sons, and this was 4th. It was a girl, but I don't think about it a lot.
Yeah.
Certainly aware that somehow or other there was another person.
Yeah. Yeah.
Never got to know that person.
I think with your mom, like, I think it's easy to forget for guys, like, you can make them think, oh, it's so strange, women are these walking incubators for, like, all these months. But also the kind of intimacy you have with that person, you know, is a way that I think males just won't understand, because just their physical experience is gonna be different.
Yeah. Well, all that stuff about feeling the stomach and feeling the baby moving around. When it's your stomach, your baby.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It made a big impression on me, but certainly must have been more profound for her.
Yeah. There's a poem I should try to send you sometime, or if you haven't seen it. It talks about second helping. And I think it's by an author who might have had experience similar to yours, and you know, he feels he kind of got that reprieve, but he's also aware that, in what he calls, I think, his second life, you know, like, you know, he's having to take it a little easier and give up some of the pleasures, and like in his first life, he would like get seconds of Thanksgiving, and now because whatever reason, he, you know, he just goes for that one serving, and the understanding that's just the kind of way it is. But it's better than no second life at all, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I never had thought, well, now I've really got to get a bucket list because
I've got this
reprieve here.
Right, right.
But I just thought that, you know, as I look back, I didn't do that. But I thought, well, I enjoyed being alive, and I still do.
Are you still with what I think you once referred to as the kind of crafts and smoking group?
Yes.
Yeah. So, what kind of crafts do you do? When you get around to the crafts, what kind of crafts do you do?
Mostly smoke. We have a shop in the basement. There's one guy there who's actual artistic, and he makes quite a few things. I just make conveniences, you know. Flower boxes and things like that. One guy made one. Got a bunch of plexi bars, chopped them up in sort of non-singing wind chimes, air chimes, sunlight chimes. But it's really just it's a social occasion.
Actually, just if you don't mind the tangent, has smoking been a big, good part of your life? Do you think it's getting stuff from it?
Yeah. I quit smoking cigarettes because I had the flu, and after after I recovered from the flu, cigarettes just tasted horrible.
Nah.
That's a really big virtuous thing. I just didn't want to smoke them anymore. But pot smoking, yeah. The thing is that it doesn't have all of those bad physical effects that smoking and drinking has.
Yeah.
And no such thing as a hangover, at least I've never had one. So it's just a pleasant overlay to the rest of your life.
I know I have to be careful in terms of I'm at the point usually where like if I don't have my head in the right space that I will get that kind of anxiety and that neurotic kind of thing. So I have to sort of sometimes the anecdote is one time, you know, like the George W. Bush was using the terrorist threat level as a political tool, and, you know, like, oh, look over there, quick. And the threat level had just been raised, and I got a little baked, and I was suddenly all uptight that, like, oh, maybe I'm doing this enjoyable thing when I should be fleeing, and I'm doing it to avoid fleeing, and then I got, like, neurotic and kind of stuff like that. So I do know that that's the only... I think it's the closest equivalent I'd worry about in terms of hangovers and stuff like that.
I've never had any paranoid feelings or anything, but I've never been particularly interested in anything else. I mean, I took acid back in the days when everybody took acid.
I was going to ask about that. Was that transcendental? Was it amazing?
I did that.
But did it change your outlook in life?
Well, I think that meditating is practicing concentration. Because that's basically what I do. And I still do it every now and then. Just, you know, just lie back, close my eyes, concentrate on my eye in the middle of the forest, and it's pretty profound, but I don't do it every day or every week. I do it every year, certainly, but not all the time, but it's just like another tool I have. We have the same trash can. Hit it off.
I wonder what you're so interested in over there.
I like it, but kind of not concentrating on it or anything like that. Goofing along. I did say that dying didn't make me want to accomplish things that I hadn't accomplished. It was another interesting experience. Gee, you gotta really pull your socks out now, buddy.
Yeah, yeah.
Socks still down.
It's interesting, like, one thing's for me, I'm definitely, you know, I've never had a strong by self desire to say, like have kids on my own. I think I accepted that, like, for certain relationships, it might be par for the course, and I think I would hopefully step up to be that good, that good father figure. And then, as I think I might have shared, or maybe not, there's a lesbian couple, friends of mine, who asked me to be a donor. Have you heard this story?
No.
Oh, okay. So there is a lovely little 2-year-old running around who has my jeans, half my jeans, and half one of her mom's jeans, but she has two moms. And I'm invited into that extended village as sort of an uncle figure, which I happily accept, and I think it is a very good fit for me based on how I've also been sort of a virtual uncle for friends' kids. Because being an only child, I can't be an actual uncle. But I think that, I mean, I don't think it's rise to the point where, like, I don't think I would be, like, on my deathbed, like, oh, crap, I wish I had done that. I think it's certainly definitely a unique treasure in my life to know, like, what is it like to see sort of, like, your heart running around someone else's body, you know, kind of thing. And again, the excuse to sort of, again, she's only two. So I think in some ways, the really interesting parts of personhood aren't even there yet.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do is actually...
Wouldn't be so sure.
Yeah, that's true too. Every time I visit, which has been on average about once a month, roughly, I actually write a letter to her, I'm thinking maybe 15 or 16-year-old self.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of... Again, I tend to be the sort of retrospective guy, and a little bit self-absorbed. I can't deny that. But introspective, yeah, I hope so, and thoughtful. But it's funny, like, when I turn, like, 22 or so, or 23, my life is so much more documented than, like, before then. I'm 42. So the first half of my life is so much more poorly or in unevenly documented than what I've done lately. Over the past 16 years, it's been like a daily diary, and then also blogging, and now I'm discovering 20 years of photos, digital photos. And before then, it's funny because when I look back to my 15-year-old, of course, it's really awkward when I read like my diaries when I'm 15. I'm such a, some of us want to say putz, you know, I'm precocious, and I'm weirdly, you know, trying to wrestle these kind of theological things and trying to be very, almost sanctimonious in some things, but also still trying to get it on with gals, you know, a little bit.
Yeah.
And so it's, anyways, the short is I'm writing these letters to Cora, I like the term super niece. Instead of a great niece, he's my super niece, because depending on your perspective, we're a little closer than a typical, genetically, we're a little closer than a typical nephew-niece type relationship. But on the other hand, culturally, which I think is important ways, it's decided that no, I am absolutely not a father. I am a donor plus an uncle.
Mm-hmm.
So super niece and super uncle is the term I like.
Is she gonna know about you?
Absolutely. In fact, it's always from the initial negotiations, but talks and stuff about, you know, exactly what it wanted to be. Both moms were on board, and I was very fond of, like, as soon as that she was, like, aware enough to, like, ask the question, she would get the honest answer. Especially with me invited as a, you know, with two lesbians, they want to make sure that there are also, you know, positive male role models and figures that she can hopefully see what is a, hopefully, reasonable, you know, sense of manhood and a way of being a guy in the world and that stuff. So I was invited from that point of view. Lately, it's actually interesting, they said to me, after a lot of talking, you know, we decided that, like, we weren't even going to, like, make it a, I guess the difference was, like, make it a, like, a big, not Maury Povich, but, like, surprise, he's, you know, but, like, no, as she, like, go ahead and say things like, oh, you have, you know, your Uncle Kirk's nose, and, like, you know, like, give little hints or suggestions that there is this connection here. Genetically, even as the family and extended family relationship is what it is, and is what it is, I mean, and isn't what it isn't. So,
let's just say, speaking intimately here, was this a test tube donation?
Yeah, it was pretty much roughly speaking, the turkey baster method.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite exactly that, but for all intents and purposes, that kind of at home, not using a lab, not going through that stuff, but also not not involving a physical act of love, in quotes, but was just me providing them a sample and then saying, okay, good luck you two. I'm off to New Jersey in this case, and then it actually, technically, there were two over the course of the weekend when some plotted fertility seemed like it would be high. It's literally before and after a trip down to a weekend trip to me in New Jersey, and one of the two just took the first. So the first extended weekend we tried it, it just happened pretty easily. So didn't have to go through a lot of expensive lab work or anything.
So she'll end up taking care of you maybe someday.
Well, you know, I have to admit, and I don't want to admit, but like that's not entirely off my radar. It's like, oh, someone who will like give a shit when I'm like really old, and but I don't want to put that on them. You know, I think as someone who's elected, well, first of all, I think there are very bad reasons to be a parent, right? Like, you shouldn't be a parent, A, as your retirement fund or retirement plan, B, as company. You know, there are two things that's in my judgment, is not the best reasons to be a parent. You know, but that said, the prospect of someone who you've attached to and sort of have your back a little bit in the age is, obviously, no one ever wants to be a burden to any other generation. And in this case, I feel like I have less of a quote, again, moral claim isn't the right term, so I'm not sure if anyone should have a quote moral claim, but there's even less of that because I have avoided the work, the big thing I avoided was sort of the big moral responsibility of like, oh, here's this big uncertain world, maybe everything from global warming to nuclear Armageddon to whatever, all these Mad Max situations that could arise, and do I want to bring a kid into that? And I knew I was neurotic enough that I didn't want to like make that big thing that this is all my fault.
Yeah.
So I think with my avoidance of that, I don't get to get all the kind of benefits and perks of being a father, because I'm not. I'm a donor and an uncle, and hopefully a good uncle. That said, you know, if she wants to look out for me when I'm old and decrepit and she's still young and spry, then, you know, I'm not going to say no. but I'm not going to, I'm going to try to do less demanding of that than I might in the,
well, it's not a question of demanding, but if you're in a circle, call it a family or not, you have more responsibilities than the people who aren't in that circle.
Yeah.
And, you know, you attempt to be a positive influence, as you say, and so forth and so on. That's all happening. And totally natural. Really.
Yeah. And what?
I mean, they did ask you.
It's true. And
admired your genes.
And trust me, there are fewer greater compliments than that. I was at the top of a very, very short list of theirs, and that is immensely flattering. It's a really lovely, lovely scene, and it's one. It's funny because like, I don't like it. You know, so the people who are like always showing like, oh, let me show a picture of my kids. I don't know. I try not to be too much that guy in terms of always bringing it up like the drop of a hat, but it is something really special to me.
She's going to be the high school valedictorian. You're going to be very proud.
As a 2-year-old, she's wicked smart right now, so I got my hopes. And it's funny too, like, if you just, I do. It's interesting you said, like, you know, people even when they're young, like one or two, you know, there's some things that are being set in terms of the person the adult should grow into. On the other hand, I know, just, you know, I'm looking forward to when I can engage with her more sort of intellectually and more thoughtfully. And I'm also, you know, there's a funny cartoon I love I'm not sure I can describe it very well, but it's basically this kid like saying like, or no, it's this old man showing a kid, not old man, a middle-aged, or a parent showing a kid like, here, like, here's Star Wars, love this, here's Back to the Future, love this, like, love all this stuff, be me, and you know, like, there's a scary stuff that a certain geeks must, especially geeks, and everyone must avoid in terms of like trying to get their kid to like confess that their generation is the best, and it's weird, like, in some ways, pop culture is sort of getting stuck, you know, like, Transformers, the movie, and, you know, G.I. Joe, the movie, and, like, all this stuff that was big in the Pokemon is the current, like, hot video game, which is, like, big in the, it's past my generation, it's a little bit, 2 years younger than me, but it's just sort of attempts, like, it's pop culture to, like, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, whatever.
Yeah.
In a way, you saw less of in like. Do you feel this at all? Like, when I look at the at fashions and styles, you can tell the 50s from the 60s, and the 60s from the mid 70s. And actually, it's funny. Most of the decades, think of the decades, actually start in the middle of the decade. Yeah. They don't start at the beginning. So, like mid 60s, mid 50s, mid 60s, 60s to 70s, 70s to 80s, 80s to 90s. And then from 90s to 2000, mid-2000, 2000 to the 2010s, it seems kind of stuck. Like, I could go to the Gap in 1997, get myself a pair of either khakis or maybe jeans. Admittedly, like, waistbands have gone up and down a little bit. But besides that, like a shirt. And it feels like there's been a certain weird stability. Do you see any of this?
Well, I loved the Gap. I really missed the Gap. That was my kind of clothes.
Still around, right?
I guess, but I don't shop there anymore. I have more clothes than I need. But I don't know. I was noticing in the paper the other day that the guy in Garfield, the owner of Garfield.
Oh, Jim Davis? Garfield, you said?
Yeah, the character in the strip was also him. But he was dressed exactly like me. Like I'm dressing now. Dressed today.
Yeah.
And this is all kind of new because I got these high socks and these shorts. And I've never worn that before. I just looked and I said, oh my God. I'm still in style.
There you go. I always do think, like, there's some theory that says, like, the Gap, and it's weird, like, it's upscale brand Banana Republic, and it's low-scale brand Old Navy. But it sort of made a certain type of middle-class look achievable. Mm-hmm. And, like, in the 90s, they advertised, like, Picasso wore khakis. Einstein wore khakis. And like, they made it sort of like kind of generic, rough look, kind of very, it kind of stabilized things because like suddenly everyone could look like aspirational middle class if they wanted to, and that was kind of enough.
I thought that was a bomb.
It's been really good talking with you, Tom.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
It's interesting. I'll be looking forward to seeing what you make of it, if anything.
Maybe if you can say, I mean, first of all, I have no idea how the audio on this is going to be. I didn't do a lot of, like, a lot of test things or whatever, the audio's bad. I got to get, like, a real little radio mic or anything. So, hopefully it'll come out okay. And maybe I'll even consider seeing what a professional transcription service runs.
I'd advise it because it would save you a lot of trouble that you're not contributing to.
As a guy who's been lucky enough to fall into kind of a high-tech field and also has a lot of projects on his mind, things that sacrifice a medium to small amount of money for a lot of time are usually a good trade-off, I found. It's very easy to get into like false economy with that. Like you know, if you don't... Again, I'm not saying I should, like, I shouldn't think of everything I want to do as, like, my hourly rate. You know, like, my salary would be for my job. But it's not entirely an incorrect way of looking at things either.
On the other hand, if you're off, you off at the beach and somebody's there typing away.
Yeah. Well, that's also too just the amount, the ability to appreciate time, just enjoying wasting time, which I've read some interesting articles that it's like people have totally forgotten, or people are like, and this someone says with every advance of technology, the tedium becomes more unbearable. And you know, sometimes that's true. Like we now can like, you know, entertain ourselves in so many ways and be connected to people via social media, like on the go all the time. And again, realizing this is a new thing. Recognizing this is a thing to be kind of poo-pooed and whatever. It's not new. Like in the 50s, they thought like, oh my God, we're boring ourselves to death with these like magazines, yeah. And then or radio before then, or even like novels before then. Different generations, each one thinks, you know, is worried that like, oh, we're not like really devoting ourselves to higher intellectual purpose. We're just kind of filling our kind of monkey brains with like whatever comes to hand. But it's just a natural thing we do, and this is, and so. I forgot what's going on with that, but you get the. Oh, just in terms of trading time. Well, no, just appreciating and not getting freaked out about like not wasting time, but just like blowing off time. Just like, just being and. Like, what happened to our. Oh, hello. I was just going to talk about you. Okay. I think we're all set for the check when you get the chance.
Sure. Grab that right away. I'm done here. Thank you.
How did you get here?
Drove.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Well, I tried getting along without a car, but you can't live in the suburbs without a car.
It's tough.
I gave it about 6 or 8 months and so that.
Did you try any of the zip car stuff, or did you just try the T?
What?
Sorry. Did you experiment with any of the zip car stuff at that point?
I tried to do the T. I never got to the point of having a car. I think it. When I was working, I had a super T pass because at the job they'd give you a choice between having a super T pass and having a parking space.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And I thought, gee, I'd rather have the super T pass. So I enjoyed that. I was really pretty good at getting around and so forth. But living in the suburbs, you're just going from one T-connected place to another on a T-connected place. And there's no damn T route that runs down Washington Street in Denton.
Yeah. And my friend Peterman says, though, I was talking about, I don't know if you're sure if you heard zip cars, like your rental, like the weird rental. So, I'm hauling my tube around enough that I don't think it would be, like, worth it, but...
We got the largest possible instrument and the smallest possible car.
Yeah, I love that. I love that car. It's just perfect enough for... just to haul it around. Actually, I don't know. I drove. Right. It's kind of funny. I don't want to say because not true. Because you're.
Take your time. Like a little more water.
No, I think we're good.
We're good.
Thank you. I'm about to float out of here.
What's your cup to?
I got it.
Oh, let me give a tip then.
Okay. Put about a 15 tip. Happen to have 15 handy?
Yeah. Now, let's be generous.
Oh, okay. I think we've gotten. I was looking at the timing of this. It looks like 2 hours.
Yeah. Your waitress appreciates some cash too.
All right. Okay. That's good. That's good to keep in mind.
So I never put the tip on the bill.
Interesting. What's the advantage actually?
Tax advantage.
Just a little. Keep it under the table as opposed to over. I got it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This was fun.
Yeah, it was. Absolutely. It was really good.
Yeah.
Actually, so, I think about the proportion, probably only maybe a fifth of it or something. It's about the whole, your interesting story about the whole dying coming back.
Yeah.
The whole zombie town I'm dealing with in front of me. You don't have a hunger for brains or anything, right?
No, no. Never have. Always felt like I had enough on my own.
It's funny with the band, you know, last year, like Marie and especially David, your son, were doing more leadership, and David actually recognized.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a great night.
Thank you. Actually recognized that he was just getting a little burnt out between the stuff and work and stuff. He was just not, and so I've sort of, So I've sort of stepped into that leadership vacuum a little bit, been a little bit more everything from like directing when we're there, which is sometimes tough because I want to be doing the bass line and I'm like, okay, can you do a solo? You know, it's frustrating to get around sometimes. And then
I described somebody as a walking jam session.
What's that?
Walking jam session.
That's what that's the goal. And also just in terms of not completely. There's absolutely other people are pitching in terms of, especially like figuring out gigs and stuff. But other things, especially in terms of like sometimes describing how the rehearsal went. You know, like those emails I send out. You know, like doing that. And it's just been interesting trying to sort of fill that leadership vacuum that our band always has. And part of it catches into my martyr complex, right? Like I want to be like, I think there's a part of me that wants to be like shown as important. So I tend to get myself into groups. I'm more attracted to groups when I know I'll be important. Like when I went to the UU in the summer, I did not realize New England had this whole thing of like in the summer churches, like their attendance just turns into a church that might be a running faucet turns into a little a shutdown, a little drip until the fall.
Yeah.
But I got there in the summer and I was like, oh, I recognize this little scraggly church, hardly any people. Like I know I can maybe it can be important here subconsciously at least, and then. The fall came, and suddenly the spigot was turned back on, and everyone was there, and I was like, oh, I'm not as important. And sometimes it's good, because it means I want to be crucial, but on the other hand, it's not as good, because it means I want to be, like, I want to be respected for being important, kind of stuff. So, that's one, you know, just a personal thing I struggle with. All right, should we head
off? You don't go to the cape.
What's that?
You don't go to the cape.
No, for what? For UU?
No, for anything. People here go to the cape for the
whole summer. Oh, for the summers. No, I missed the whole summer brigade. All right, I guess with this, I'll officially end our taped conversation. And then...